Welcome to the SDF conferencing system.
There are two other parties in this
conference. We'll pick up the countdown shortly here, and H-minus 10 seconds. The countdown will come directly from the timing and firing trailer.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
Quantel, opt-in, opt-in, go tape.
This is Publius bringing you A Step Farther Out. Your weekly radio message from the Man and Atom Society.
There are two other parties in this conference.
Hello and welcome. Publius will be joining us shortly. Please stand by. Your ears are very important to us. Your call will be ordered in the received of which it is. This is not a recording. Thank you, Adam D. This is not a recording. It certainly is not a recording. I think Publius even dialed in and then hung up. The man, it sounds like something a recording would say.
There are three other parties in this conference.
Andy C.
If it were a recording, my timing would be better.
Oh, excellent. Okay, I will hand it off to you. Here's Publius.
Thank you to SMJ for that excellent intro. Sorry, I still am having trouble getting my timing right, even though I am, even though I got that wonderful sting to bring in the beginning of the program so you know what you're listening to. Now, first things first, Tuesday coming up is the 20th of July, the glorious 20th of July. Anniversary of man's first footsteps upon a planetary body other than the Earth, unless perhaps you believe in ancient alien theory, which we can neither prove nor disprove at this time. July 20th, also being a Tuesday, on my regularly scheduled show, Hear Now the Words, I will be playing some of my space-themed records. I've got several, both documentary-style and weirder-than-that records, based on the, you know, issued in the 60s and 70s. And so I'll be playing some of that. Tuesday the 20th is also when Jeff Bezos is scheduled to make his ascension into the Mesosphere, which perhaps he'll try to purchase the naming rights and rename it the Bezosphere. Can't prove that. Can't disprove it. Wouldn't be prudent, right? We shall see what happens with that. I certainly wish him every good fortune. I would not like to have a failure which ends in death, simply because that will be bad for space activities in general. It always is. Now, it's important to note that the flight profile or concept of operations of the New Shepard, which is the Blue Origin human-carrying vehicle in question, is very, very different from that of the Spaceship Two. Spaceship Two, you have an airplane which carries a rocket plane up to a certain altitude, then drops it. The rocket fires. The rocket plane goes up, 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 in a long parabolic flight, and then comes back down. For most of its flight, it's outside the sensible atmosphere. It comes down, and then it's when its wings begin to bite, right? When there's enough air pressure for atmospheric interfaces, it then glides to a landing. Okay, the New Shepard concept of operations is something totally different. The New Shepard has a rocket booster which sits on a launch pad, and it fires, and it goes up. And then the rocket booster and the human-carrying capsule separate. The human-carrying capsule goes to a slightly higher altitude than the rocket booster simply because it's denser, and thus the atmospheric friction as you're leaving the lower reaches of the atmosphere has less effect on it. The booster stage comes down and lands vertically under rocket thrust, and the capsule descends ballistically and lands with the aid of parachutes. One thing this means is that the G forces of the New Shepard are a great deal higher than those of Spaceship Two. This is not generally appreciated, that because of the much shorter trajectory length that Alan Shepard in his suborbital flight was subjected to quite high G-forces. And this will also be true with the New Shepard spacecraft. So all in all, it's going to be a somewhat bumpier and much briefer ride than the Branson folks had last week. Just thought I would clarify that for those who weren't aware of the significant differences between the two concepts. From a safety point of view, I admit that I am somewhat concerned by the New Shepard concept for one simple reason, which is that the takeoff and the landing rely on two completely different and unrelated systems, which means that both of those have to work right for safety, whereas, of course, with the Spaceship Two, you only have to really have one thing that works for safety. I don't know. This is a consideration which was brought to my attention by some X-Corps folks good 15 years ago or so. So we shall see what happens. And again, I wish them every success. If we're going to have super rich people, which I don't necessarily think is a good thing, having them use their wealth in ways which promotes what I consider to be very, very important objectives is certainly a more socially positive outcome than other possibilities. Now, last week I spent some time talking about copper, and I want to revisit the subject of copper just briefly, because it brings up a point which is of much broader interest and importance. Copper has three basic uses. One is for conveying electric power. One is for conveying electrical signals, and one is for transmitting heat. Now, there are other applications in which it's used. For example, copper granules and copper sheet used on roofs because of the bactericidal properties and things like that, fungicidal properties, that kind of thing. Sheathing the bottoms of wooden ships for the same reason. We don't do a lot of that anymore, of course. Maybe that's the solution to the zebra mussel problem. There's a thought for you. Get rid of zebra mussels by copper plating your fiberglass boat. Anyway, but that wasn't what I came here to talk to you about today. No, I didn't come here to talk to you about the draft either. I'll let Arlo do that. But copper has these three functions. Well, as it turns out, we have, over the past half century, taken many of the functions which we used copper for, and we've begun using instead, right, we've shifted those functions onto aluminum and onto glass. Optical fibers for carrying signals, right? Aluminum, very extensively used in long-distance high-tension electric power transmission lines. Not so much used in electronics, in small motors, although it certainly could be. There was a period when it was used extensively in house wiring, but got a bad reputation because that was badly implemented. There are some important differences between aluminum and copper in behavior, and they weren't adequately accounted for, and the result in some cases was fires, which you do not want. But much of the work that we used to do with copper has been shunted off onto aluminum and onto glass. Well, there's some important considerations which arise from that circumstance. Firstly, copper is relatively scarce in the crust of the Earth. It tends to occur in a fairly concentrated form, which is one of the reasons why it was basically the first metal that our ancestors began to use. It occurs in native form, that is, as metal, reduced metal, and where it occurs in the form of sulfide ores, it's frequently fairly concentrated. And then there are much larger masses of what's called, for example, porphyry copper, which is very diffuse deposits of copper sulfide. And as you can imagine, early on in our history of metalworking, we tended to use up the richest and most accessible deposits first. And then, as time has gone on, we've been forced to go for the thinner deposits, the deposits which are less concentrated, the deposits which require more treatment, the deposits which produce more waste in extracting. And the result is that obtaining copper is a laborious, a costly, and an environmentally damaging process, which makes big pits in the landscape, for example, out in Utah, and produces sizable amounts of toxic waste in the form of tailings, which have been leached of most of their copper, but there's enough left of copper and other things which co-occur with it, such as arsenic, to form a hazard to living organisms, or simply inhibit living organisms from existing at all. So copper is, although really wonderful in many ways, it's not exactly benign. It has its problems. Well, aluminium is immensely more plentiful than copper in the crust of the Earth, and the deposits of it are widespread. Now, we use bauxite as our primary source of aluminium, but at a relatively small increased cost, you can use clay. And clay is basically everywhere. It's a product of the weathering of feldspathic rocks such as granite. It's ubiquitous. And as long as you don't use grades of clay that are highly in demand for something else, such as making porcelain, or in the case of bentonite, using as packages for nuclear waste, obtaining clay is an operation which doesn't have a huge environmental footprint. As long as you have a non-polluting source of cheap energy, the production of aluminium is a pretty benign operation, all things considered. You know, aside from electrolyzing, right, separating the aluminium from the aluminium oxide by passing electric current through it, the other main operation involves digesting the aluminium minerals, the bauxite or clay, with caustic soda, which is produced from seawater by an electrolytic process. Comment in COM from SMJ reminds me that another application of aluminium, which is not an application of copper, is in rocket propellants, that your solid rocket boosters on the space shuttle, for example, are ammonium perchlorate, which is a horrible artificial chemical which can't exist in nature because it really doesn't want to exist, and synthetic rubber, a hydrocarbon, and aluminium powder, because the aluminium powder, combusting with oxygen, releases an enormous amount of heat. Only trouble is the product of combustion solidifies at a very high temperature. It doesn't produce a vapor, so most of the vapor is produced by the decomposition of the ammonium perchlorate, which produces a lot of ordinary nitrogen gas, and by the destruction of the synthetic rubber. But that is an application which copper is not used in. Very small quantities of copper may be used in fireworks to give a color, but other than that, that is not an application for copper, rocket propulsion. But where was I? Yes, oh yes, I was saying that we have successfully substituted for many of the uses of copper, which is difficult to obtain and environmentally damaging, aluminium or glass, both of which are much easier to obtain, and assuming always that we have a clean, cheap source of energy, also much less environmentally damaging to obtain. Which means, of course, that far more people can enjoy these services, such as telecommunications and electricity, all those services, thermal services, electrical services, power services, that is, thermal services, electric power services, communication services, which in the past were provided by copper, now being provided primarily by aluminium and glass, more people can enjoy them for the same aggregate environmental impact, for the same aggregate economic cost. That's important. People talk a lot about overpopulation, about how there's too many people in the world. And here's the thing. Technologically, we humans have been very successful at reducing the environmental footprint of the individual, even while increasing the standard of living. That the amount of land required to support an agricultural peasant in Egypt or medieval Europe is far less than the amount of land required to support an individual hunter-gatherer. Now, the impact on that amount of land is more intense, but it suggests a general trend. In the 20th century, of course, with the artificial fixation of nitrogen, we have literally increased the amount of biomass that can exist on the Earth, because that figure was always limited by the rate at which nitrogen could be fixed by various nitrogen-fixing plants in competition with processes which tend to decompose fixed nitrogen and release it back to the atmosphere as nitrogen gas. So it's not without its inconveniences, of course. Giant algal blooms at the mouths of rivers due to runoff of excess fertilizer application being a great example. But we have literally increased the amount of biomass that the Earth can support, and not by a little. That really means an increase in the carrying capacity of the Earth. Now, to do more to increase the carrying capacity of the Earth, we would probably have to do something to reverse desertification, meaning we would have to get water out of the oceans and spread it on areas of the land which are currently very arid and let plants grow there. And that would mean a big shift in certain delicate ecosystems, and it's not clear whether that's such a great idea. So we might not want to continue increasing the aggregate carrying capacity of the Earth. We can, however, continue reducing the individual ecological footprint. For example, if we're going to be producing fresh water by desalting seawater, we can use that in greenhouses in our cities to produce most of our food, and then let the land which we've been cultivating to produce food be retaken by whatever natural ecosystem we displaced to make room for our crops. This is a very important consideration. Now, the ideology, if that's the word, of overpopulation, the idea that, oh, well, there are just too many people using these resources, there are too many people, they have too much resource demand, we just can't survive. People will connect that with the Club of Rome report, The Limits to Growth, in the 1970s, for example, or they'll go back to Parson Malthus, the English academic. But it really goes back a lot further. It goes back to the very dawn of agricultural societies for a reason that may not be immediately obvious, but is very important. When you have an agricultural society, at first, if your population is growing, that's an advantage for two reasons. First, it means you have more labor to work the fields. Secondly, it means you can have a greater amount of specialization of labor. Specialization increases efficiency. When somebody concentrates on doing a specific task, they can do it more efficiently than if they're constantly changing from one task to another. Now, there's a countervailing phenomenon in that people aren't machines. We don't do our best. We don't live our best lives when we're always doing exactly the same thing over and over. In fact, you get things like repetitive strain injury, which tells you don't do that. But on a broader picture, specialization increases overall productivity. So initially, when you're an early agricultural society, population growth is an unmitigated good. Then you get into a middle region. The middle region is dictated by the fact that agricultural land varies in productivity. Now remember, we're talking about early agricultural societies, so we're principally talking about, for example, Egypt, Mesopotamia, and the river valley societies in China, which didn't have to worry about exhausting the fertility of the soil because it was replenished every year by the floods carrying silt down from the mountains, from the interiors of the continents. Exhaustion of the land adds another layer of complexity to the argument, but some land is more fertile than others, and more particularly, some land is more suited to growing the particular crop, the specific crop that your agricultural society has oriented itself around. So, for example, barley in the case of Egypt, millet in the case of ancient China, rice came later. So some land is better suited to that, and of course that's the land you wind up cultivating first. And for a while, as you expand, you're still on that high productivity ground. But eventually, you start having to cultivate ground which is less productive. And for a while, you're still ahead of the game because, firstly, the initial ground was so productive. And secondly, due to specialization, each additional unit of labor, that is to say, the work done by each additional person, is that much more productive. But eventually you reach a point of diminishing returns where you're cultivating more and more land, but the yield of the last hectare that you're cultivating is not making nearly as big a contribution as the average hectare. And that's the situation in which typically your ancient societies with narrower and narrower grain surpluses would become more and more vulnerable to adverse weather events, because farmers always have the problem of bad years. So adverse weather events, not to speak of, you know, possible raids by Pastoral Hill people and so on, and suddenly you don't have enough food to feed your entire population. People starve. And when people are starving, they tend not to continue about their accustomed tasks, not to go about their ordinary routines, which means that that division of labor that was so effective in increasing your productivity, yeah, it collapses. Suddenly, you go from, you can go in a year, as an agricultural society operating on thin margins, you can go for a year from having 10% more food than minimum starvation requirements for your people. And honestly, that's what ancient agricultural societies mostly look like. 90% of the population, more or less, is living on the absolute minimum that people can live on, and then you have the remaining 10% is the elite, is consumed by the elite, the priestly class, for example, the scribe class, the landowning class, whatever they're called. They are consumers of food, and they are producers of art and literature and culture, but not of things that people need to survive necessarily. This is important, right? This means some really important things, because it's that elite class which gives you all of the things we remember about ancient civilizations. All the things we remember even about, say, most of the things we remember even about the Renaissance European cultures are generated in a relatively small elite stratum, which consumes the food produced by large numbers of peasants. In the modern world, it's very different. We have energy. We have technic sources of energy to do these jobs. We have eliminated a lot of the labor in agriculture. I keep coming back to this idea of breaking the curse of Adam. In the sweat of your brow, you shall eat your bread all the days of your life, except that if you're driving across your field in an air-conditioned tractor, I don't think that really applies anymore. But people say, well, there are too many people. This is an argument I have to address. I don't really have the time here to address it, but I want you to think, can there ever be too much thought in the world, right? People do thinking. Can there ever be too much creativity? Can there ever be too much joy, too much love? No. What we have is not an excess of population. What we have is a lack of opportunities for people. Every day in poor countries around the world, children with an aptitude for math and engineering who could potentially, if given an opportunity, chip in to solve the problems which really do face our world. Children with an aptitude for diplomacy who could chip in to solve a different set of problems that face our world. Children with an aptitude for literature and music who could make our lives so much better. These children are forced to abandon education if they ever had a chance at it in the first place, and they are forced to go engage in menial labor in order to feed their families. Menial labor of a kind which has been eliminated, or nearly so, in the wealthy countries of the world. These people, these children, their lives are every bit as important as my life, the life of anyone listening to this. They just never get the chance to be the kind of people that so many of us get in the wealthy countries. In the wealthy countries where primary school education is not only free, it's compulsory. If your family doesn't send you to school, bad, you know, they'll send your parents to jail, right? In most of the wealthy countries today, university education, trade schools, all of those post-secondary education are very easy to get. And in most wealthy countries, they're also heavily subsidized. The necessities of your life are to a great extent taken care of while you're engaging in those activities, because everybody knows that society is better for it. But that's only possible in a society which has lots of energy, lots of resources, which can afford to make sure that everybody has the opportunity to be a human being instead of a glorified draft animal. And that's your message for today. for this week. I'll take it further next week. You have been listening to A Step Farther Out, the weekly radio message from the Man at Adams Society. Feel free, if you like these extended rants, to support me with a little donation, paypal.me/PrometheusLives, and in 5 seconds, upcoming is the Dubious Goals Committee with Tobe, which airs every day on the non-radio at 1930 UTC.